KSVP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
One of the dangers here is that the allure of nuclear weapons becomes all enticing.
As Iran and Israel trade strikes for a fifth day, what is the risk that Iran decides to race for a nuclear weapon?
For Tuesday, June 17th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. As the Trump administration looks to cut Medicaid, a new poll shows many Americans really like the program.
Large shares of the public say that either they or a family member have ever received some type of coverage through Medicaid. And so I think it hits a little bit closer to home for them.
Plus, Juana, you got to hang out with the best-selling female gospel artist in history.
That's right. Cece Winans stopped by the Tiny Desk, and who knew? That woman can sing.
The live audience will pull things out of you that you didn't even know you had. There's nothing more powerful than people coming together and worshiping.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A meeting of President Donald Trump's national security team wrapped up with signs the administration may be warming to the idea of having the U.S. play a role in Israel's ongoing strikes against Iran. Exactly what that means is not clear, though NPR's Franco Ordonez reports it would be a major policy shift.
This is really a significant pivot for Trump. I mean, when Israel launched its strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities last week, the White House emphasized that the U.S. was not involved. But now Trump's suggesting that the U.S. is involved. I mean, he's saying things like, we have total control of the skies. We know where the supreme leader is hiding. I mean, he's taking more ownership. You know, he went on to say that the supreme leader is safe for now, but indicated that that could change if civilians were targeted or American soldiers.
Some U.S. assets, including a third U.S. Navy destroyer and a second U.S. carrier strike group, are in or are headed to the region. Israel says it's begun a new wave of airstrikes against Iran. A Democratic U.S. senator who was dragged out of a DHS press conference last week is pleading for a bipartisan response to the Trump administration's immigration raids. NPR's Claudio Grisales reports Senator Alex Padilla made the remarks during an emotional floor speech.
Senator Padilla recounted his forcible removal by law enforcement officials last week. He said he was escorted by FBI and National Guard officials into the room where Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem was speaking. But another set of officials grabbed him as he tried to ask a question.
And marched down a hallway, repeatedly asking, why am I being detained? Not once did they tell me why. I pray you never have a moment like this.
Padilla went on to urge people to continue the fight against the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration. Some Democrats have argued the aggressive tactics are fueling new waves of political violence. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
Growing number of high-paying jobs no longer require a college degree. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports they're known as new-collar roles.
Think cybersecurity analysts, cloud support specialists, project managers, and wind turbine technicians. Many of these jobs offer salaries of $80,000 to more than $100,000 a year, plus flexible hours and options to work remotely. These companies are using skills-first models, looking for hands-on experience, certifications, and problem-solving ability over academic credentials. Tech companies, manufacturers, and clean energy firms are leading the way, offering short-term training programs instead of four-year degrees. Experts say the trend is opening new doors for job seekers, especially those priced out of college or looking for a faster path to financial stability. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
This is NPR. Chase is hiking the cost of its popular credit card, often used by people to collect travel points and rewards. The new annual fee is nearly $800, and has Chase surpassing many other premium cards by rivals like American Express. More from NPR's Alina Selyukh.
The card is the Chase Sapphire Reserve, highly sought after, particularly for travel rewards. Its annual fee is currently $550, going up to a whopping $795 in October. The company had long offset its steep fee with a reimbursement for travel expenses of $300, and that amount is not increasing. Though Chase is promoting various new rewards, including deals with Apple TV, rideshare company Lyft, and food delivery service DoorDash. The news exploded online, where scores of Chase users are posting alarmed comments and reconsidering their loyalty to the card. Aline Seluch, NPR News.
An Illinois toy company is taking its case against the Trump administration's tariffs all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The company Learning Resources, Inc., filing an appeal requesting the court take up the case sooner instead of letting it play out in the lower courts, arguing the tariff should not have been imposed by President Trump under an emergency order, but should instead have been approved by Congress. Companies seeking to expedite its appeals, saying the tariffs and the uncertainty around them are taking a major toll on the company's business operations. Oil prices continue to surge as escalating tensions in the Middle East and concerns about how they could affect global supply roiled commodity markets. Oil rose more than 4% today to settle at $74.97 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It's been a day of saber-rattling on Iran. President Trump took to social media to demand unconditional surrender, all caps. Trump wrote, quote, "We know exactly where the so-called supreme leader is hiding. He is an easy target, but is safe there. We're not going to take him out. Kill, at least not for now."
Elsewhere on the show today, we'll take a deeper dive into what Trump is saying about U.S. involvement in this conflict. Right now, we want to step back and mark this fifth day of deadly missile salvos between Iran and Israel. The stated reason for Israel's preemptive attack boils down to this: the decades-long fight to keep Iran from building a nuclear weapon.
This operation will continue for as many days as it takes to remove this threat.
That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking last Friday as Israel's attack got underway. To talk through the stakes and the history of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, we have called Aaron Stein, president of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Aaron Stein, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I want to start with Israel, which is the only country in the region with nuclear weapons, although they have never admitted it. How did that come to be?
Well, it's a policy of opacity where the Israelis, you know, largely in conjunction, I wouldn't say with the acquiescence, but the rather sort of forced hand of the United States, said, you know, the United States came to the Israelis and said, look, we know that you're building nuclear weapons. We don't agree with it, but we don't want a cascade of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. So let's agree to disagree that you should have nuclear weapons. But if you do go ahead and pursue nuclear weapons, let's just keep it in the closet for as long as possible. And hence, you have the policy of opacity that was born and that we're still living with today.
Although part of the point of nuclear deterrence is to show everyone you have nuclear capabilities, so don't attack us because we have nukes.
Oh, sure. You know, the Israelis don't really make a secret that they have it. They just don't really talk about it. It's like Fight Club, the movie, which is like everybody, you know, you're the first rule of Fight Club is that you don't talk about Fight Club. The first rule of Israeli nuclear weapons is that you don't really talk about them in public, even though everybody knows that you have them.
So to Iran, then, which we are told is very close to having a nuclear weapon, has assembled the fissile material they would need to have a nuclear weapon. What's your understanding of how close they are?
Well, Iran had an active nuclear weapons program up until 2003. The U.S. intelligence say that Iran halted that nuclear weapons program, which I like to think of as a pause. So if you're watching a DVD or you're streaming something, you pause it. And so the screen remains on your television as a clear image. And so they have all the requisite capabilities to build a nuclear weapon. They just decided not to. What the Israelis are talking about is that they've accumulated enough enriched uranium to where if they wanted to enrich it to weapons grade, they could do so very quickly and then thereafter assemble it into a nuclear weapon.
If Iran is taking any lesson from this moment, with Israel raining down missiles on their capital, on their nuclear facilities, would that lesson be that nuclear capabilities matter? That they will make your enemy think twice before attacking?
That is my personal opinion. Now, look, when you're sitting in Tehran, you're suggesting that, look, we didn't really trust the United States, but we reached the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal, with the Obama administration, only for it to be ripped up by the Trump administration, even though we were abiding by it. And then we engaged again with the Trump administration, only to be attacked by the Israelis. The idea would be something along the lines of, well, maybe we need nuclear weapons to not be attacked by the Israelis.
So that is an inherent risk here, that by attacking Iran, it will cause Iran to race for a nuclear bomb.
That will be my personal metric of success for the Israelis. Everything that we're watching is defying expectations. The Israelis have established air superiority over Western Iran and Tehran in ways that we didn't really think possible. They've attrited Iran's missile forces, but if they don't get after certain nuclear facilities, and Iran has the capability at the end of this thing to rapidly build a nuclear weapon, I will have judged this a failure on the Israeli side.
What about the rest of the region? How closely are Saudi Arabia or Turkey or Egypt watching? They're watching Israel, which doesn't admit it, but has nuclear weapons. Iran, which doesn't admit that they are moving toward a nuclear weapon, but could do so if they wished.
Oh, I think everybody's watching. You know, one of the big concerns with when the Israelis, the Pakistanis, the Indians, you know, back in the 1970s were openly flirting with nuclear weapons is that this could start off a cascade. The U.S. and its allies at the time, ironically, including the Soviet Union, were able to head that off. Now, you know, we're in the Wild West here, which is the capabilities to develop nuclear weapons have proliferated around the world. And so one of the dangers here is that the allure of nuclear weapons as sort of the symbol to deter conflict from external actors becomes all enticing for people in the Middle East, but also for other non-nuclear countries around the world.
I just want to let the gravity of what you're saying sink in. I mean, how do you think about that? The risk of a nuclear arms race potentially in a region that is already so volatile.
Well, that's why we invest or we elect leaders who ostensibly care about these things. Look, the United States and the international community has tools, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, all other things, to try and head this off. It's just that the barriers to build nuclear weapons are not what they once were.
So what are you watching for next as these nuclear stakes play out?
Saudi Arabia, you know, they're a long ways away, but, you know, they have been in intermittent negotiations with the Biden administration and now with the Trump administration, and it's really centered around, you know, that they have the right to enrich uranium. That doesn't mean that they will, that they mean they will quickly, but they have said if the Iranians can do it, we can do it, and so why are you treating us sort of as second-class citizens in our own neighborhood? And so that's what I'm watching first and foremost, which is where the sort of proliferation dynamics that take place after this war ends. Second of all, will the Israelis be able to knock out all of Iran's enrichment capability? You know, we've talked a lot about the deeply buried bunker in Fordo. It's under a mountain. And if they don't get that, Iran will come out of this with the capability to continue to enrich uranium at high levels.
The program will have been slowed, but not stopped.
Correct.
Aaron Stein, he's president of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Medicaid keeps getting more popular. That is according to a new poll out today. At the same time, Republicans aim to cut federal spending on the health insurance program by $800 billion as part of their tax and budget bill. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has the details.
Medicaid has always been quite popular. In January, a poll from the health research organization KFF found 77% of the public had a favorable view of the health insurance program for low-income people. Just a few months later, it's gone up. 83% of the public is now in favor of Medicaid.
I was pretty surprised by the uptick in Medicaid popularity because it was already so popular.
Ashley Kurzinger is KFF's polling expert.
The largest uptick we saw in favorability over the past couple months was among Republicans.
The findings come as Republican senators unveil a new version of the major legislative package drafted in the House, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The House version included deep cuts to federal spending on Medicaid. The Senate version includes cuts that are even deeper. Part of the popularity of Medicaid is its reach. Medicaid provides health coverage to 71 million low-income and disabled people across the country. An additional 7 million low-income children are enrolled in the Children's Health Insurance Program, known as CHIP. It's funded through a combination of federal and state money.
Large shares of the public say that either they or a family member have ever received some type of coverage through Medicaid. And so I think it hits a little bit closer to home for them.
While Medicaid is popular, the tax bill is not, according to the KFF poll. Overall, 2 in 3 Americans have unfavorable views of the bill. Even more people dislike it when you tell them about the projected effects these steep cuts could have. The Congressional Budget Office projects 10 million people on Medicaid could lose their coverage, and it would hit the finances of local hospitals. Here's Kurzinger.
The more people hear about the ramifications and the messaging around this bill, then I think it really could shift attitudes one way or the other.
Republican lawmakers frame Medicaid as a financially unsustainable program that needs to be cut back to preserve it for the most vulnerable. It's also part of the calculus to help pay for tax cuts and more border funding. Republican senators are rushing to finalize the bill before the July 4th recess. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
A leader in the fight for a woman's right to run has died. Nina Cusick was 86 and the first official women's champion of the Boston Marathon.
She is wonderful, just with a capital T, trailblazer.
That is Valerie Rogoshevsky, who ran alongside Cusick and 6 other women in the 1972 Boston Marathon, the first year they were permitted to compete in that storied race.
We were only welcomed into the race 3 weeks before the race, so there weren't too many of us that were ready to go.
Now in her 70s, Rogoshevsky says she remembers that day well.
I think we all sort of knew that it was a very kind of a historical moment. I know that none of the 8 of us was going to drop out. And I also felt like none of the 8 of us was even going to walk because we felt that there were eyes on us. I just felt proud that we actually had a female winner. I think that was my overriding feeling, that finally women were being recognized.
Back in the 1970s, many people thought it wasn't safe for women to run that far.
Even doctors were saying that women could not or should not run 26 miles because they might not be able to bear children after that. Their uteruses might, fall out, something like that. And so it just felt like a real uphill battle.
Nina Cusick battled for that, right? Rogoshevsky says Cusick's work meant more to her than anyone could know.
She was just a really fine person. I remember I saw her just 3 years ago when we went to Boston to celebrate 50 years. And she was struggling with dementia then, but through it all, she was just so friendly, so open, so warm. She was quite a woman.
Quite a woman indeed. As Cusick told a reporter after her Boston victory in 1972, according to Runner's World magazine, running is neither masculine or feminine. It's just healthy.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. More than 5 million people turned out at more than 2,000 No Kings protests over the weekend. That's according to organizers' estimates. And the size and scale of anti-Trump protests has been growing compared to President Trump's first term. That is according to the political scientist Erica Chenoweth at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Chenoweth co-directs the Crowd Counting Consortium, which documents political mobilization in the United States. They have called this widening movement an American Spring. Erica, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, so we talked a while back, and when I talked with you then, you told me that crowd size, crowd diversity, and a disciplined message are some of the factors that really make for a successful protest movement. So I'd like to ask you to take stock of the protests that we saw over the weekend. In your view, did they have those elements?
Well, my team is still tallying the protests from the No Kings events from around the country. But anecdotally, at least, and for the records that we've already validated, it's very clear that the general sense of many of the people who are participating was that they felt their own power and agency in participating in the protests. The second thing to note is that the day came off with potentially millions of people in the streets, as you mentioned, and with very few incidents of injuries, arrests, property damage, or anything else that might play into the narrative that the movement is not disciplined, is not nonviolent, and is not democratic in its ethos. You know, the other piece is that it was truly nationwide. There are reports of, for example, at least 1,000 people in the town of Bath, Maine. That is well over 10% of its own city's population. And so there was a very widespread nature to the mobilizations that I think set it apart from, you know, previous eras of American protest.
You've taken a look at the size and the scale of protests in President Trump's current term and compared them to those that happened during his first term. Can you tell us a bit about what you found?
Sure. So my team at the Crowd Counting Consortium, which I co-direct with Jeremy Pressman, has been tallying protests every day since the Women's March of 2017. So we've got a lot of years of comparative data day over day for what has been happening in the country. And what we've been able to, we think, pretty reliably demonstrate is that through May of 2025, there have been well over three times as many protest events in the United States as has happened during the same period in 2017. The second thing about the protests that's really interesting and important is that over 99.5% of those thousands of protests during the April and May period alone featured no injuries, arrests, or property damage. That's an extraordinarily nonviolent movement, especially for the number of events that we have seen.
Despite your findings, at least up until June, that protests have largely been nonviolent, we have seen the Trump administration use isolated instances of disorder to justify, for example, commandeering California's National Guard, to sending Marines to that state. So I wonder, to your mind, is there a danger here that widening political protest could invite additional use or displays of force coming from the federal government?
There's a scholar named Christian Davenport who a number of years ago wrote an article called The Law of Coercive Responsiveness. And in that article, he makes the claim that any time a protest movement actually becomes powerful and threatening, the government will respond with force. And the more powerful and threatening a movement is becoming, the more powerful the response with force. One way to interpret the escalation is as a sign of the growing power and impact of the movement. That said, as you indicated, there is certainly a danger to protesters for engaging in protests once it is more threatening to the government and more politically threatening, I should say, when the government, for example, bundles peaceful protesters with those engaging in violent criminal acts while protesting. but I would say that it's a predictable response when a movement is gathering power.
That's political scientist Erica Chenoweth of the Harvard Kennedy School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A federal judge in Boston has ruled that the National Institutes of Health acted illegally in terminating some 800 research grants. The grants focused on topics related to diversity, transgender issues, and other areas of research unpopular with the Trump administration. Now, as Craig LaMolt of member station GBH reports, some scientists with canceled grants are unsure what the ruling means for them.
U.S. District Court Judge William Young ruled the NIH's terminations of those grants were arbitrary and capricious, and he ordered the agency to immediately resume payments. Attorney Rachel Mirapol of the ACLU represents some of the plaintiffs and spoke after the ruling.
NIH had come forward with no explanation as to why important medical research, it seemed like it would be essential to protect the health of people in this country, why it is all of a sudden on the chopping block. The agency completely failed to explain what it was doing adequately to the American people.
The judge went on to address what he described as a darker aspect of the case that he said he felt compelled to address. He said the government's termination of grants on topics like health disparities amounted to racial discrimination and discrimination against the LGBTQ population.
We are so, I guess, grateful to hear it finally spoken out loud that this is indeed discrimination.
That's Arielle Becha of Harvard. Her research is studying mental health inequities experienced by LGBTQ populations during the pandemic.
It makes real tangible difference in the lives of marginalized communities when we have evidence to say, here are the inequities and here are solutions.
But in March, she got some surprising news.
And it was an email from the NIH saying that effective immediately, the grant was terminated because its focus no longer aligned with agency priorities.
On Monday, Judge Young ruled that roughly 800 terminations like that were illegal and are now void. Even so, Becha says she's not sure yet what the decision means for her and her research.
I'm not sure if my grant is included. I'm reading almost every article I can that's coming out reporting on this court decision, and there's no clear answers yet.
The list of 800 terminated grants that was referenced in the trial has not been made public. Attorneys for the ACLU say the ruling only applies to parties involved in the lawsuits. That's the researchers who were named plaintiffs, as well as members of the American Public Health Association and the union UAW. And researchers at public institutions in the 22 states that also filed suit. Kenneth Pereno is an attorney with the group Protect Democracy, which represented some of those plaintiffs.
We're incredibly grateful for the bravery of our clients who have stepped up in this fight. I mean, this is an existential crisis here for science and public health. They put a lot on the line.
Even for those grants that are clearly included in the judge's ruling, it's not certain yet that they're going to get their funding back. In a written statement, a spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services said, quote, HHS stands by its decision to end funding for research that prioritized ideological agendas over scientific rigor and meaningful outcomes for the American people, end quote. The statement goes on to say that HHS is exploring all legal options, including filing an appeal and moving to stay the order. For NPR News, I'm Craig LaMolt in Boston.
This is NPR News.
A new war between Israel and Iran is underway, but what role does the United States play? President Trump has said he wants a real end to the conflict, but does that mean a new nuclear deal or regime change in Iran? We'll bring you every development in the war between Israel and Iran and follow the next steps for the White House on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's all things considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, the U.S. co-hosts soccer's World Cup next year.
The U.S. men's team has high hopes for the tournament, but there's drama between the star player and the coach.
When I sign my contract in the federation, I am the head coach. I am not a mannequin.
That's ahead after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans are considering adjustments to the bill that acts as the cornerstone of President Trump's agenda, including making his 2017 tax cuts permanent. But as NPR's Barbara Sprunt tells us, new provisions are setting up a collision course in the House.
The Senate Finance Committee released the highly anticipated legislative text, which addresses programs like Medicaid, clean energy tax credits, and other hotly disputed items. This comes after the House passed its version of the bill in May, after narrowly overcoming internal divisions. Some of those House members who are at the center of the negotiations have already said the latest text from the Senate crosses their red lines, like not enough of a deduction for state and local taxes. Some senators are also concerned the Senate language makes too many adjustments to Medicaid. Senate Republicans want to pass the bill by July 4th. Barbara Sprent, NPR News, Washington.
The State Department has set up a task force to help Americans caught up in the Israel-Iran war, but so far there's no word on any planned evacuation routes, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce says the Middle East task force is working around the clock.
We continue to monitor the complex and rapidly evolving situation on the ground as we continue to assess and address the needs of U.S. citizens.
She stopped short of announcing any plans for evacuating Americans from Israel, where the main international airport is closed. There are hundreds of thousands of Americans there, but the State Department won't say how many are reaching out for help. The State Department has issued travel warnings throughout the region and has authorized the departure of family members and non-essential employees at the embassy in Israel. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The price of oil is up. Signaling as Israel's conflict with Iran continues. This is NPR. Charleston, South Carolina is remembering one of the nation's most heinous hate crimes. NPR's Debbie Elliott tells us it's been 10 years since a white supremacist killed 9 black worshipers at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church.
Events at the church this week will honor the memory of the Emmanuel 9 and the 5 people who survived Dylan Roof's racist attack during Wednesday night Bible study on June 17, 2015. Emmanuel's minister of music, Wayne Singleton, says even a decade later, the pain feels fresh.
You wouldn't expect something like this to happen in your sanctuary. This is one of the safest places you should feel safe at all times. And to have someone to violate that sanctity, it really hurts.
The shooter, intent on starting a race war, targeted Mother Emmanuel, the oldest black congregation in the South. He's now on federal death row. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Charleston.
Los Angeles is lifting its curfew put in place last week after confrontations with police and protesters. A small section of downtown was put on curfew amid protests over ICE immigration raids in the city. But after 2 nights of relative calm, Mayor Karen Bass is lifting the nearly week-long curfew. The L.A. police chief credits the 8 p.m. curfew with stopping looting as well as vandalism of property downtown. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at subaru.com/care. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The FIFA World Cup is just a year away from being hosted here in the U.S., so you might think there'd be optimism, all kinds of excitement around the U.S. men's national soccer team. Instead, it is doom and gloom, and that is thanks to a losing streak and also drama between the team's coach and a star player. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is always game to talk drama, and she is here now. Welcome.
Thank you.
What is going on with the men's national team?
Yeah, you know, like you said, this is really supposed to be their moment. They're on the doorstep of this huge opportunity, not just like in the World Cup, you know, not just to have what could be their best result ever. Their best ever result in the World Cup is a quarterfinal. Can they get that again? More importantly, I think, is like having the World Cup, doing well in the World Cup here on American soil.
Yeah, getting all of us fired up about it.
Exactly. Leveling up the sport as a whole here in the country, as hosting the World Cup back in 1994 is widely credited with doing in the U.S., like launching soccer into a greater level of popularity. So, and I think U.S. Soccer acknowledged this is such a huge opportunity, too, because they hired a new coach last fall to steer them through this time. They scheduled all these friendly matches against major international competition that were all the caliber of teams that they would need to beat in the World Cup in order to advance. Well, they have lost, you know, two of those in March, another two earlier this month, Panama, Canada, Turkey, Switzerland. That four-game losing streak was the team's longest since 2007, and so that really has set off this, like, blue mood around the team after that.
So it's not going well on the pitch. And meanwhile, what's with the drama?
Yeah, so this is all centered on Christian Pulisic, who is the 26-year-old star of the team, the face of the team in the last World Cup, and the new coach, Mauricio Pochettino, who started last fall. So basically, Pulisic, best player on the team, but asked to sit out of this tournament that is going on this month called the Gold Cup, and has ended up not playing this summer at all for the team. His absence has drawn criticism from former national team players, including Landon Donovan. And so last week, Pulisic went on this CBS Sports podcast to explain that he felt like he needed the rest after a long season. He didn't want to risk an injury. Here's what he said.
I had to make the best decision for myself, and also, you know, in the long run for my team, even though clearly some people haven't seen it that way.
And he added that he had been willing to play in some games this summer, just not all of them, not this whole tournament. But he said when he brought that to Pochettino, Pochettino said no, left him off the summer roster altogether.
Huh. Okay. And the head coach says what in response to all this?
He responded over the weekend. So Pochettino was in a press conference for this tournament that's going on. He was asked directly about his conversations with Pulisic about playing this summer. And he essentially said, look, players shouldn't be able to dictate the plan. They have to listen and stick to the plan that we, the coaches, make, even when they're the best player on the team. Here's what Pochettino said.
If he performs well and he's the best, it's normal. He's going to have a place in the national team. But when I sign my contract in the federation, I am the head coach. I am not a mannequin.
I'm the head coach. I'm not a mannequin. He says it's me who gets to make these decisions, not the players. He did say some very nice things. He was very complimentary about Pulisic as a player and as a teammate, I should say. And I think, you know, barring injury, it's a lock for Pulisic to make the team next year. He is that good. But ideally, I think you're looking for a good relationship between coaches and players, not airing this kind of stuff out in public. So maybe that's something they're still working on. And certainly with this tournament going on, a distraction for the team.
So about 30 seconds left, but are they going to get back to actually, I don't know, like focusing on playing?
They're trying. They are trying. They are in the middle of the Gold Cup. That started last weekend. Despite the distractions, they had a great opener on Sunday with this 5-0 win over Trinidad and Tobago. They're not the stiffest competition, but it was very important to end the four-game losing streak. Now they've got games in the coming days versus Saudi Arabia and Haiti, and then potentially a knockout round that could include the higher level competition like Canada and Mexico. Lots of young players are getting the chance to prove themselves right now. So if they can win this tournament, beat some good teams, I think that would change the narrative and up the excitement around the team.
We will be watching. Becky Sullivan, thank you.
You're welcome.
This month, a new president took office in South Korea, promising to reduce tensions and resume dialogue with North Korea. His first move was to unilaterally call a halt to psychological warfare operations along the inter-Korean border. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports on what that means for residents.
Long-legged white birds swoop over rice fields in the farming village of Dangsanri on the inter-Korean border. 1 mile across the Han River estuary is North Korea. If you look up in the hills, you can see a loudspeaker which blasts unsettling noises at Dangsanri at all hours. We visited last week while the loudspeaker wars were still in progress. An Hyo-chol is Dangsanri's village chief. He says a public health clinic did a survey to gauge the impact of all the wailing and screeching noises on residents.
They didn't ask every single resident, but they found 100% of the people they asked are sleep deprived. But still, the government is doing nothing except for soundproofing windows, and not even for all homes.
The two Koreas have been blaring propaganda at each other on and off for more than six decades. The South restarted the broadcasts last June in response to the North sending trash-filled balloons into the South. Village Chief An says the South needs to move first to end it.
What we are all asking for is that we stop our own broadcasts toward the north for at least 1 or 2 months. And if they stop, that's the simplest solution. If we stop and they don't, then that's out of our hands.
Some people, though, think the South's broadcasts are an effective tool. An Chan-il is a former North Korean soldier who says he was persuaded by the broadcast to defect to the South in the 1970s. He says he sprinted across a minefield in the demilitarized zone, ready to kill himself with his pistol to avoid capture if he stepped on a mine. Before that, as his army rations dwindled and he felt hunger pangs, An listened to broadcasts describe how the South was surging ahead of his country in private ownership of cars, fridges, and TVs.
While I was hearing the numbers, I was also seeing with my eyes. Because I was manning outposts inside the DMZ, the helicopters and the vehicles moving on the other side.
An is now president of the World Institute for North Korean Studies. He argues that the South's broadcast should not be seen as psychological warfare because they're welcomed in North Korea's closed society.
I think we should reframe it as a cultural operation or cultural communication and use it as a way to enlighten North Korean soldiers and residents.
For years, the North belted out propaganda trashing the South's leaders while praising their own. Since last July, that was replaced by just noise. Village Chief An's wife, Kim Ok-soon, says it makes no sense.
We're under the sonic bombardment every day. It would be much better if actual bombs fell. At least then, the government would do something about it.
Then, last Wednesday, President Lee Jae-myung called a halt to the South's broadcasts. The North returned the favor the next day. He says he wants to restore trust and engagement with the North. But defector An Chan-il argues that Pyongyang is more interested in stopping the broadcast to save scarce electricity than to resume negotiations with the U.S. or South Korea. And even before the loudspeakers fell silent, as the moon shone over the rice fields of Dangsanri, it seemed the sonic battle was already being won by crickets and frogs. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Dangsanri Village, South Korea.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Alfred Brendel, a highly respected Austrian pianist, has died at the age of 94. He was best known for piano playing, which fused a keen intelligence with musical clarity. Jeff London offers this appreciation.
Other piano players were flashier. Other piano players were perhaps more outwardly passionate, but Brendel had legions of ardent admirers. Even Alfred Brendel himself confessed to documentary filmmaker Mark Kidell, who profiled him in 2000, that his success had been something of a mystery.
My career is atypical. I
have not been a child prodigy. My parents were not musicians. There was no music in the house. I have a good memory, but not a phenomenal one. I'm not a good sight reader. I'm completely at a loss to explain why I made it.
Brendel was widely praised for his thoughtful, lucid piano playing. But Tim Page, a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of journalism and music at USC, says it wasn't for everyone's tastes.
Some people found him dry. Some people found him perhaps a little bit over-scholastic. But there were others who really felt that this was a really first-class musical brain working on, you know, some of the great music in the repertory.
Alfred Brendel was born in Weisenberg in what is now the Czech Republic in 1931 and spent his early years in Yugoslavia and Austria. While he had some formal training, including a couple of years at the conservatory in Graz, Austria, he was largely self-taught. After an appearance in London in the 1970s, his international star began to rise. Brendel was best known for his interpretations of the standard classical repertoire, like Mozart, who wrote music that was deceptively simple, he told Lisa Simeoni on Performance Today in 2000.
When you play the sonatas, you are all alone, and there are relatively few notes that you have to play, and every single one of these notes lays bare. It is a delicate balance between poise and seemingly casual delivery, which is necessary.
Brendel, who also wrote volumes of poetry and essays on music, found himself frequently returning to the composers he loved. He recorded the complete works of Beethoven 3 times.
Because I'm not one of the pianists who learn a piece, play it, and discard it. I feel that one should keep in touch with those pieces which are really worth playing and live with them through a lifetime.
Alfred Brendel retired from piano playing because of arthritis in 2008, but he continued to write and lecture. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. 30 years ago, a young gospel singer from Detroit named Cece Winans released her first solo album.
I'm safe and sound, serene and calm.
That album, Alone in His Presence, went platinum and it won her a Grammy.
My secret place.
Today, Cece Winans is the best-selling female gospel artist in history.
Times are harder now than they've ever been before.
That's Winans at NPR's Tiny Desk the other day. She came by to help celebrate Black Music Month, and after the show, we stole a few minutes with her in the All Things Considered studios.
First of all, I just have to say, you took us all to church today, so thank you for bringing that energy, that positivity, that spirituality into the NPR office.
Oh, well, thank you. I had a great time, great audience. We had fun.
I'm here to let you know there's always hope for you.
I mean, when I think about gospel music, it's not just something we listen to, it's something we feel with our bodies, it's something we experience. And when I think about growing up in the church, I've always associated it with this really big sound, the big choirs, the big congregation singing and clapping along. So I do have to ask, what was your first thought when you found out you would be playing at a tiny desk without any of that?
I just wanted it to come off good, you know, because it is a different setting. But then it took me back. It really took me back because growing up in the Winans household, we did a lot of rehearsing in our basement, you know. And in your basement, you don't have the microphones, you know, and a lot of our friends would be around. So actually today at Tiny Desk really took me back. And I just said, I'm going to have fun. I'm going to enjoy it, you know, just sing from the heart. Because I think sometimes we try to make everything too perfect, you know, and I think the most powerful thing is when it just comes from the heart and you're having fun. And that's what we did.
Alone in the presence of you.
Now, you played an incredible roster of songs for us, including Alone in His Presence, which is from your debut album that has the same name. It came out 30 years ago. I remember listening to it growing up.
Wow. Were you even alive?
I believe it or not, I was. I just wonder, 3 decades later, what does that music mean to you now?
Oh, man. It means more and more every year, every decade. You know, when I get to go back and visit my younger self, I can just nod my head and say, yep, His presence is definitely my hiding place, being the Spirit of God, and I live a life to please Him, and that has brought me good success, you know. And good success is not always your songs being on the top of the charts, but good success is being able to go home and have peace in your home and be able to sleep, you know, and just experience peace.
You have, though, also experienced so much commercial success, and you kind of time traveled back to the present today with us and played a few more songs from your most recent record, More Than This, which won you another Grammy for Best Gospel Album. And this one's interesting because it's also a live album recorded with an audience. Tell us about that choice.
Oh, man. I love being in the studio because I love being able to do it over and over and over and over again. But there's nothing like a live audience. The live audience will pull things out of you that you didn't even know you had. There's nothing more powerful than people coming together and worshiping, you know, lifting their hands, crying out to God, and everybody singing together. And that's what people are feeling when they listen to this live record. They are feeling the Spirit moving, but they're feeling the unity of the house.
Sometimes I fall my knees and pray. Come, Jesus, come. Let today be the day.
You recently sang one of the songs from that album, Come Jesus Come, with the gospel legend Shirley Caesar. I have to know what it was like to work with her. I see this huge smile on your face.
Oh, my God. Now that's who I grew up on. That's who paved the way for me. And man, when I tell you she still got it, I was just so honored that she said yes, that she would sing it with me. And when she came into the studio, I mean, she opened up her mouth, and man, every note is just seasoned with salt, pepper, green pepper, onion. I have no words. I'm just totally grateful that we got a chance to sing Come Jesus Come, and it is powerful. We need you right now. Come and turn this around. Deep down I know this world isn't home. Come Jesus
Think about in the 3 decades that you've been making music solo, all the different sort of ebbs and flows of what makes gospel music, what it sounds like when you started out. You were part of the movement that ushered in contemporary gospel, yeah. Fusing yep. the traditional with the modern.
Uh-huh.
So when you look at gospel today in 2025, what do you think the next evolution is going to be? What's the next turn?
I don't know. When I look at the young artists that are out now, they are incredible. And I just don't think there's a limit to creativity. We have the rap, we have the contemporary, we have the traditional, and we have so many new things that are evolving, and I just think it's exciting. I don't think there's a limit to what's going to happen. I just think it keeps getting better.
I think what I love most about gospel music is this strand of hope that runs through all of it. The hopefulness, the idea of turning to a higher power outside yourself, the idea that you are not in control and that there is a God that is responsive, as you said, to our faith. I just wonder, where do you find hope? Where do you see hope? And how does your music contribute to that hope?
Well, you hit it on the head. You know, I get hope from what I do. That's one of the privileges in doing gospel music, because it is a form of music that is always uplifting, always encouraging, reminds us that we're loved. Like you said, reminds us that we have a God who is on our side. And if we just hold on, you know, the light will come, the sun will come. A weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And it's in that same good news that I find my hope. I don't have to fear about what's going to happen, because I serve a God who knows the end from the beginning. So I can actually experience true peace of mind and heart because of that relationship. So my hope is in Him.
I wish I could tell you, wish I could describe it, but I can't contain it, can't keep it to myself.
Cece Winans, thank you so much for blessing us with this Tiny Desk concert. It's been such a pleasure.
You got it. Thank you. Great talking to you.
And you can find her full Tiny Desk performance for Black Music Month at NPR.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from RBC Wealth Management, where financial advisors work to understand individual goals and are dedicated to providing customized advice to help strengthen financial security. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.